From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we discuss the war between Israel and Hezbollah with Augustus Richard Norton, professor of international relations and anthropology at Boston University. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and has written widely on Shia politics. Also, actor Matt Dillon. He earned an Oscar nomination for his performance as a racist cop in Crash. He was a heroin addict and drugstore cowboy and played a bully in the film My Bodyguard. He's currently starring in You, Me, and Dupree and the upcoming film Factotum. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Negotiations continue in the United Nations over a ceasefire proposal for Lebanon, aimed at ending the fighting between Israel and Hezbollah, which has resulted in hundreds of civilian casualties. For some perspective on the crisis, we turn to Augustus Richard Norton. He's a professor of international relations and anthropology at Boston University. Before entering the private academic world, Norton had a 27-year military career that included 2 combat tours in Vietnam, 12 years on the faculty at West Point, and 14 months as an observer in southern Lebanon in 1980 and 81. Augustus Richard Norton is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and has written widely on Shia politics. He has a forthcoming book on Hezbollah. I spoke to him yesterday. Well, Augustus Richard Norton, welcome to Fresh Air. The incident which touched off the current fighting was this raid by Hezbollah, apparently quite well planned to attack Israeli forces and capture some soldiers. What do you think prompted Hezbollah to undertake this action?
Since the 1990s, Hezbollah and Israel have developed a very clearly understood set of rules, if you will, rules of the game. And these rules basically defined how combat would be conducted in South Lebanon. One of the basic rules was that civilians would not be attacked, for example, that Israeli territory would not be invaded. In return, the Israelis would not bombard Lebanese civilians, and so on. These rules of the game were so well understood by both sides that after various incidents, would not be unusual for an Israeli general or a Lebanese official or Hezbollah official to remark that this or that operation was within the rules of the game. What happened on the 12th of July was that Hezbollah was trying to stretch the rules. The operation that was conducted was not in Lebanon. It was actually inside of Israeli territory. And, of course, the purpose was to capture Israeli soldiers as bargaining chips in order to leverage the freeing of Lebanese prisoners in Israeli jails. There had been a major prisoner release in January of 2005, but several of the prisoners were excluded from that release by the Israelis. So this was basically to finish the deal from the standpoint of Hezbollah. Unfortunately, Hezbollah was trying to stretch the rules, but for the Israelis, this is the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak, and they, in effect, tore up the rule book at that stage.
Do you believe that there was, you know, some talk that Iran might have urged or ordered Hezbollah to undertake this, to take attention away from its own difficulties regarding its nuclear program, or that Syria might have played a role? Was this Hezbollah leaders acting on its own, do you believe?
I've said from the very beginning that I think it's very unlikely that this was directed by Tehran, certainly not by the Syrians. The Hezbollah-Syrian relationship is not of that nature. This is an operation which had been, in effect, announced and planned some months before. In fact, it was an unsuccessful attempt to do something very similar in November of last year. So this was a matter of a target of opportunity. I think that in many ways what's happened, of course, is not necessarily in Iran's strategic or geopolitical interest. And I'm doubtful personally that that Iran ordered the action. I also note that U.S. government officials have noted on several recent occasions that there's no evidence that they've discovered to indicate an Iranian role in directing the July 12th operation.
Okay, clearly Israel responded with an attack that it seemed to have been planning for some time to go to sweep in and attack Hezbollah positions in Lebanon. And, you know, a lot of people looked at this and said Israel was in a position that no sovereign state could tolerate. I mean, a sworn enemy with 10,000 rockets right on its border, an enemy dedicated to the destruction of its state. And that this campaign, with its regrettable consequences to civilians, was, in effect, a legitimate exercise of national defense. What about that argument? What do you think of that argument?
Well, I think there's something to that, but before I address that in more detail, let me remind our listeners that from 2000, the year 2000, to the year 2006, and 2000, of course, was the year that Israel withdrew its forces from occupation in Lebanon. During that six-year period, a total of one Israeli civilian was killed by Hezbollah fire, and about 25, in fact, exactly 25 Israeli soldiers were killed during that period of time. While those casualties are regrettable, that compares to an average number of Israeli deaths during the years of occupation of about 25 per year. So many Israeli officials have admitted, it's well on the record at this stage, that that six-year period was quite quiet by historical standards, and that, in effect, the border was more or less stable. Now, Israel had every right to respond to the provocation by Hezbollah on the 12th of July. However, in my view, and I think in the view of many other foreign policy specialists, what the Israelis have done is really over the top and is quite counterproductive for reasons that I'll be happy to explain. And it should also be said that this war, this Israeli war, for in effect hegemony, is really an Israeli-American war. Early on, George Bush called on Israel to exercise restraint, not to target Lebanese infrastructure, not to target the Lebanese government. Either the Israelis blew off George Bush, which is unlikely, or they understood that Bush was saying this with a wink and a nod. And in fact, the dawdling diplomacy that the U.S. has practiced since the 12th of July, as well as the large shipments of arms, jet fuel, and so on, not to mention intelligence, clearly indicate that this is not simply an action by Israel. This is an action by the U.S. and Israel together.
Yeah, I want to go back to what you said a moment ago, describing this action as, in effect, an act to establish hegemony by Israel. Now, you know, you noted that they did, in fact, withdraw from Lebanon in the year 2000. And it does seem that in the period since then that Hezbollah has increased the number and sophistication of the weapons it has acquired from its international allies, thereby increasing its ability to strike more deeply into Israel. I mean, again, coming back to the argument here, I mean, didn't Israel have a right to attempt to neutralize such a dangerous threat to its own population right on its borders? How do you see that as an attempt to establish hegemony?
The Israelis have said repeatedly that one of the goals of this war is to reestablish their, quote, deterrence, unquote. And really that means hegemony. That means their ability to ensure that their neighbors, their adversaries, do not do anything that offends Israeli interest. Now, I grant your point, and it's certainly true that Hezbollah has acquired a significant arsenal, and we see evidence of that every day in terms of the weapons that are being fired and so on. And if the Israelis could have eliminated that arsenal relatively quickly and cleanly, as Ehud Olmert promised George Bush in a private discussion, then it would be a different matter. The problem is that this is difficult terrain. This is a hardened force which was honed, basically, under years of Israeli occupation, and a force with a lot of social support. And I think it's important to remember that the Israelis have killed 20,000 Lebanese civilians over the last quarter century. So the people, particularly of southern Lebanon, have a very strong incentive to have a force that they can defend them. So, you know, if poof, these missiles and other weapons could have been made to disappear, that's fine. I did not think from the very beginning that the Israelis would be able to do that. And whoever the analysts were that advised Ehud Olmert or George Bush that this would be an easy operation, well, I think what they deserve is a meeting with the president or the prime minister and perhaps the appropriate comment would be, heck of a job, you're fired.
Well, I'll note as you make that comment that you do have a military as well as an academic background in this area.
Yeah, I was an Army officer for 27 years. I served two tours in combat as an infantry officer, a paratrooper. And then, of course, I've been in other combat zones for fairly long periods of time. I also taught at West Point for more than 12 years in the Social Sciences Department at West Point.
You said earlier that Israel was responsible for, I think, 20,000 civilian deaths in Lebanon over the past couple of decades.
That's right. Most of them in the context of the 1982 invasion.
Where does the figure come from?
The majority of the deaths occurred in the period 82 to 83 or 84, and these are deaths documented by Lebanese authorities. These are registered deaths. The figures have been gone over by a number of different scholars. They're pretty good. I don't remember the exact number from that period. It was something like 15,900. And then the other deaths are accumulation. Of course, there are 900 in this conflict already. In 96, there were 106 killed in a shelling incident at a UN base in Kana, the same Kana that was bombed last week. So it's an accumulation over a period of time. And during that time, of course, there have also been many homes destroyed and people displaced and so on. There's been a sort of constant movement of refugees back and forth the south from the south of Lebanon to Beirut and so on as these conflicts have gone on.
Were you surprised at the ferocity of the Israeli assault?
I was surprised because, in my view, it is so obviously counterproductive for the Israelis to be doing what they're doing. Up until now, which is to say up until July of 2006, the Israelis have responded to provocations by Hezbollah with restraint, and the opposite is true as well. Israeli commentators, for example, one leading journalist writing in Haaretz just a couple of weeks before the war began, remarked on, if you will, the rational relationship between the Israelis and their adversaries in Lebanon. So I was surprised by the willingness of the Israelis to pull out many, if not all, of their stops in terms of their assault on Lebanon. And as I've emphasized, I think that what they've done is patently counterproductive. They're in a context in which time has actually worked against them because time has allowed Hezbollah to demonstrate that it can stand up to Israel, that Israel does not have the overweening military capacity that it would like to have, and, of course, with the civilian casualties and damages to infrastructure and so on, this has had a very negative rippling effect across the region, both to the disadvantage of Israel and to the disadvantage of the interest of the United States of America.
But let me just again come back to the Israeli perspective on this. If you have a dangerous enemy with sophisticated weapons and they are deliberately embedded in a civilian population, what's the alternative? What should they have done?
Well, we have a very difficult opponent in North Korea. And for various reasons, we're not invading North Korea. There are plenty of difficult opponents. If it's a simple matter of hitting a switch and making them disappear, it's one thing. But the fact of the matter is that that isn't easily done in this case and in many other cases. My view is what the Israelis should have done is hit Hezbollah hard, which is to say, carefully delineated targets, and then used the provocation by Hezbollah in order to seize the diplomatic high ground. There was, at the beginning of the war, which is to say the 12th and 13th of July, a lot of support for cutting Hezbollah down to size. Much of that support, I'm talking now inside of Lebanon, much of that support has now disappeared. So what's happened is that we have seen a situation created in which Hezbollah is likely to emerge from this war dynamic, influential, and popular throughout the Middle East. Moreover, because of the destruction that has been inflicted on Lebanon, Iran, much against U.S. interest, will be a major provider of assistance to rebuild many of these areas which have been destroyed. I can't imagine U.S. taxpayers providing the foreign aid necessary to rebuild these scores of villages, not to mention thousands of apartments that have been destroyed by Israeli bombing. And as a result, Iran will actually gain influence in Lebanon. Moreover, the very stability and survival of the Lebanese government is now in question. So what has been created is a horrendous situation. Frankly, what the Israelis have done is strategically counterproductive.
Augustus Richard Norton is a professor of international relations and anthropology at Boston University. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Augustus Richard Norton, a professor of international relations and anthropology at Boston University. He has a forthcoming book on Hezbollah. You know, the U.S. experience in Vietnam had profound effects on its own military and political thinking, and I certainly have to believe that the long and painful Israeli occupation of Lebanon in the past affected its own leaders deeply. And when this incursion occurred, I had to think that the Israeli leaders would not have made a decision to go back into Lebanon without a carefully considered plan that was informed in some way by its earlier experience. Do you think Israel brought lessons from its past involvement to the current crisis, or is it suffering from amnesia here?
Well, I think that, first of all, this was an operation that was not conceived in an afternoon. This was a well-planned operation, and it reflects the desires of the Israelis, as I've emphasized, with U.S. support, to strike at Hezbollah, to sort of make up for some of the humiliation that has been imposed by Hezbollah and Israeli forces, and also, by extension, to hit Iran, which, of course, is the major remaining regional adversary for Israel. So there was a strategic plan here. They saw Lebanon, but they were really seeing Iran in significant measure. Now, there were lessons they should have drawn, but I think the Israeli overconfidence about what they could accomplish in Lebanon was conditioned less by a memory of what had happened in Lebanon than by their experience with the Palestinians, who they push around fairly easily.
I note that some in news accounts, some of the Israeli soldiers' deaths have come from anti-tank missiles. I mean, this isn't the kind of weaponry that one associates with the guerrilla army, really.
No, this is a these are weapons which no doubt are provided by Syria and Iran. Anti-tank weapons were used during the occupation period, frequently against Israeli bunkers and that sort of thing, though many of the attacks during the occupation phase were lower tech, involving mines, remote control mines, and that sort of thing. So there's no question that they have been ramped up in terms of the technologies that they are using. But it must be said, and in fact this is something that's easily verified, many of these weapons these days are relatively easy to acquire. There's a vast international market in what is now basically relatively inexpensive guided weapon systems, precision guidance weapon systems, anti-tank weapons, and so on. So we shouldn't be surprised to see a motivated force like Hezbollah using these weapons, and we should expect to see them in other places as well. I should also say that this war that we're playing out right now is going to have, I suspect, a momentous effect on military affairs in the region. I mean, basically what Hezbollah has provided is a model for how one confronts a modern organized military force of great sophistication, such as Israel has.
What do you mean by that? Where else will one see that lesson applied?
Well, I think we're going to see, and we are seeing actually, a sort of overflow of lessons from Lebanon to Iraq. And, of course, the Lebanon war has very much reverberated in Iraq, both politically and militarily. I mean, basically what the Hezbollah fighters are doing is fighting a very mobile war. They're not at all stationary. They're fighting in small teams, sort of triangular teams of sometimes three people. They're people who do not need sophisticated communications. They've been trained to use lethal but relatively simple weapons and so on. And they're, for that reason, they're very hard to find. And not to mention, of course, they know the terrain. This is their; these are their homes. I mean, these people are not from Mars. These are their homes. This is terrain they've known since they were babies. So I think the application in Iraq is very obvious. I think we could see much more determined and much more difficult to defeat insurgency actions in Iraq as a result of what's going on in Lebanon right now.
Augustus Richard Norton is a professor of international relations and anthropology at Boston University. He has a forthcoming book on Hezbollah. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our interview with Augustus Richard Norton about the U.S. response to the war between Israel and Hezbollah. Also, actor Matt Dillon. He began his career as a teen idol. In Drugstore Cowboy, he played a heroin addict, and he earned an Oscar nomination for his performance in Crash. He also directed his own movie in Cambodia. Now he stars in the upcoming film Factotum. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. As negotiations continue in the United Nations over a ceasefire proposal for Lebanon, we're speaking with Augustus Richard Norton, a professor of international relations and anthropology at Boston University. Before his entry into academia, Norton had a 27-year military career, which included 14 months as an observer in southern Lebanon in 1980 and 81. He has a forthcoming book on Hezbollah. I want to talk a bit about how the United States has responded to the outbreak of the war in southern Lebanon. You know, the Bush administration, of course, has effectively no relations with Syria. It regards Hezbollah as a terrorist group and stood by Israel in the early going and has begun to try and cobble together some sort of proposals for a ceasefire in place. What do you think of the course that the Bush administration has taken in this conflict?
I spend a lot of time when I'm not in the Middle East or teaching at Boston University and places like Washington. I have a lot of interaction with other people who are sort of professional foreign policy specialists and so on. And I would say that if there's one thing that almost all of these people agree on, as well as many retired diplomats and dignitaries and so on, is that what the U.S. has done is established a relationship with its adversaries, which is totally, totally nonproductive. Which is to say, we have said to our adversaries that we're not going to talk to you unless you behave like we want you to behave. Well, by definition, adversaries don't do that. We need to have a dialogue with countries like Iran, as unpalatable as that may be, with countries like Syria, and so on. The fact that we are trying to deal, for example, with the Lebanon war, without having those channels of communication, and we don't even have an ambassador in Syria, and we certainly don't have one in Iran, means that we have really handicapped ourselves in terms of the needed communications to really do the kind of quiet negotiation and discussion that has to take place. In 1996, when Israel conducted a major incursion into Lebanon, although much smaller than the current war, it was a process of negotiation involving France, the United States, Iran, and Syria, as well as indirectly Hezbollah, incidentally, that led to the closure of that particular conflict period and established a functioning set of rules that worked pretty well up until the 12th of July of this year.
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice was quoted recently as saying that the current conflict in Lebanon represents the birth pangs of a new Middle East. What was the context of that remark and its impact in the Muslim world?
The Secretary of State was in Beirut while the country was under a devastating attack. Infrastructure was disappearing because it was being blown up. People were being killed by the scores and hundreds. And in effect, the Lebanese were experiencing collective punishment by the Israelis. Secretary Rice's comment that this represented the birth pangs of a Middle East struck, to be polite, most listeners in Lebanon and beyond as insensitive, and made many people wondering what planet she thought she was on. Certainly I had that feeling. It may be that Condoleezza Rice and George Bush believe that what they're doing by supporting Israel in this war is creating a new Middle East, but believe me, the Middle East they're creating is going to be horrific in appearance and is going to bear no resemblance at all to the prattle we hear from administration spokesmen, including the president, I should say.
Well, what do you mean by the Middle East that it will create?
The Iraq war has been a catastrophe. What it has done is destabilized Iraq to the point that it is now in a civil war. We have created a situation in Iraq where one of our major adversaries in the region, arguably our major adversary, Iran, has actually been a major beneficiary. And in fact, Iranian influence in Iraq has grown very dramatically since 2003. Meantime, people across the Muslim world, but particularly in the Middle East and the Arab world, have seen this invasion as evidence of America's desire not to promote democracy and liberal values and so on, but basically to attack and destroy Iraq. The Lebanon War is similarly exacerbating animosity and enmity towards the United States. We've seen widespread demonstrations across the region supporting not Israel and the U.S., but Hezbollah. And we have seen, basically, people who are our friends and our allies, including political reformers in the region, who have been very much put on the defensive because of the fact that what the U.S. seems to be doing to the region in the eyes of the people of the region is helping to destroy it, not to build it. So I think this is very, very counterproductive. It is not, in my belief, in our interest to create circumstances where our adversaries, like Iran, actually gain influence and where movements like Hezbollah become the most popular political movement in the region.
Well, Augustus Richard Norton, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Augustus Richard Norton is a professor of international relations and anthropology at Boston University. He has a forthcoming book on Hezbollah. Coming up, actor Matt Dillon. This is Fresh Air. Matt Dillon has been playing leading roles in movies since he was 16. Known in his early years as a teen idol, he's now 42 and can look back on a career of diverse and challenging roles. He played a heroin addict and thief in Drugstore Cowboy, a dishonest private detective on the make in There's Something About Mary, and a racist cop in the movie Crash, a role which earned him an Oscar nomination for Best Supporting Actor. His other films include My Bodyguard, The Outsiders, To Die For, and this summer's You, Me, and Dupree. In 2002, he co-wrote and directed the film City of Ghosts. Dillon is currently starring in Factotum, based on the novel by Charles Bukowski, the late L.A. writer known for his confessional and painfully realistic style. Dillon's character, Henry Chinaski, is widely regarded as Bukowski's alter ego. He's an alcoholic who moves through menial jobs and failed relationships while pursuing his quest to become a published writer. In this scene from Factotum, Chinaski reflects on the challenges of writing, then interviews for a job in a pickle factory.
As we live, we all get caught and torn by various traps. Writing can trap you. Some writers tend to write what has pleased their readers in the past. They hear accolades and believe them. There is only one final judge of writing, and that is the writer. When he is swayed by the critics, the editors, the publishers, the readers, then he's finished. And of course, when he's swayed with his fame and his fortune, you can float him down the river with the turds.
A writer, huh?
Yes.
Are you sure?
No, I'm not.
Why do you want to work in a pickle factory?
It reminds me of my grandmother.
It does?
She used to serve me pickles whenever I visited her.
What do you write?
Mostly short stories. I'm halfway through a novel.
What's it about?
Everything.
You mean, for instance, it's about cancer?
Yes.
How about my wife?
She's in there, too.
Well, Matt Dillon, welcome to Fresh Air. In this new film, Factotum, you play this character, Hank Chinaski, from the Charles Bukowski novel, a guy you wouldn't want your daughter to date, probably. I mean, he drinks too much. He drifts from job to job. He has these casual relationships. And yet there's kind of something maybe deeper going on in his head. Tell us about this character and how you got into the role.
Well, for me, I guess it all starts with, my background with Charles Bukowski is that I read most of his novels and short stories when I was in my early 20s, and then I put them down, and I hadn't really thought much about Bukowski for some years. And then all these years later, the producer of Factotum and the director, Bent Hammer, approached me about playing Chinaski in Factotum, and my first reaction was like surprised, but I just didn't feel like it was something that I could do. And you know, that certainly Bukowski is a different physical type than myself, and I always thought of him as an older, you know, as an old. This is the same guy who wrote Notes of a Dirty Old Man, mm-hmm. and he achieved success so late in the game that I often, I just thought of him as an older guy. And then they reminded me, look, you're really at the right age to play Chinaski during that period that chronicled Charles Bukowski, those early years when he was trying to get published as a poet. And once it was established that they weren't looking for me to do an impersonation of Charles Bukowski, which would have been a disaster, then I knew that I could do it.
You spoke to Bukowski's widow to get ready for this. What did you get from that experience?
You know, one of the things she told me was that there's this kind of misconception or this idea about Charles Bukowski that he was a slob, that he wasn't clean, and this was something that really, really bothered him, because in fact he was the antithesis of that. He was very neat and very clean and very disciplined. And that's something that really gave me some insight into Chinaski's dignity, you know, that this is something that, you know, that he had, you know, he had this sort of pride that he would keep himself neat, that he would, you know, that, you know, one of the things the director did, Bent Hammer, was he put in a sequence where you see Hank washing his clothes and hanging them up. And in a
cheap room where he does it on a sink, actually, right?
Yeah, he washes them in a sink and he hangs them up before he sits down to write. And for me, that really, you know, that really, those little touches were really important to sort of play against what, you know, and the natural instinct for an actor is, if you're going to play a bum on Skid Row, is to, like, you know, who ends up homeless, to get down into the gutter and rub your face in it. And, this, she gave me these sort of insights that were really helpful.
Well, you know, it's interesting because you see Henry Chinaski, you in this film, you know, drinking, getting fired, going through these casual relationships. But we see the other side of the character often through these internal monologues that appear in the film as voiceovers, and our audience just heard one in the clip that we played earlier. What was the frame of mind you pictured for that character when you were doing those voiceovers? I wondered at times if you were slurring your words just a bit, as if you had been drinking. What was in your head when you were doing those?
You know, for one thing, I really tried to avoid playing drunk, just more allowing it to happen in the way that it naturally would. For one thing, he's a maintenance drinker, you know. It's not like he's not this like happy-go-lucky kind of Arthur drunk, you know, like from the movie Arthur. Or
right,
right, you know?
Not falling down over the piano, right?
Yeah, exactly. So there's that, you know. It's like he's drinking all the time, more or less, and so you know, there's that part of it. We did the voiceover stuff before we began shooting, and then we did some of it again afterwards, And I, as an actor, I can tell the stuff I did beforehand and the stuff I did afterwards, but that's a whole nother thing. I think the idea was that would be the stuff that was going on that he was writing at the time, the stuff that, you know, that he was observing around him. And so I think that's what that represented for him. I tried not to be too slurry, but there's a kind of, that was one of the challenges for me, because, you know, I listened to a lot of Bukowski doing poetry readings, and I think it was something he really didn't take a lot of pleasure in doing. I don't think he liked doing readings. And so I think there was a guarded quality to his readings, you know. That's what I picked up, that there was this kind of affectation in a way. And he had a sing-song quality, which I kind of liked. It sort of went against what, when I read Bukowski, I always imagined this gruff voice that sounded more like, you know, Warren Oates or, you know, Lee Marvin or something. But in fact, he has kind of a sing-song, almost at times effeminate sound, you know, to his voice. So for me, I wanted to kind of combine, well, who he really was and his real delivery and his mannerisms with those of Chinaski, the alter ego that he had created, if I could combine the two of them, because I do believe that Chinaski was sort of a sort of idealized version of himself in a way.
Do you want to say a little bit about playing these scenes where you and Lily Taylor have to play a couple that's kind of maintaining a relationship, sort of, you know, on the edge of employment and on the on the edge of connection to one another? I mean, it's a pretty troubled relationship.
It's interesting because in a lot of ways the film is a love story, you know, and, you know, these are characters that are pretty much set in their ways. And, you know, there's a lot of talk in film about, you know, character arc, character development, and often, you know, in films like in Crash, for example, this film that I did, where a lot of the characters, they have this arc where they come to this realization of who they are, and there's some sort of epiphany or this change that comes over them. And, you know, that's not the case. You know, I think that's like the core of what's happening, say, in Crash, these moments, you know. But that's not the case in Factotum. Factotum, these people are pretty much who they are. You know, I think you basically have these two characters who are people that are sort of set in their ways. But I think as a viewer, you discover more about them as you go along and the way that they interact with each other. Because they're two people that really, I mean, in reality, Jan, the character of Jan, who Lily plays, in real life, she was a woman named Jane. And that was the only woman that Bukowski ever sort of admitted to really having been in love with. But they seem to be two kind of doomed people. Like, they couldn't stay away from each other, but they couldn't stand each other. And in the end, they just seem to always be drifting away from each other, but kind of coming back. And I think there's something kind of human about that. I think a lot of us have been in relationships like that. It's never that clean. The break our emotions don't break away that freely.
My guest is Matt Dillon. He is appearing in the new film Factotum. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining me, my guest is Matt Dillon. He is appearing in the new film Factotum. You know, most people with a 25-year Hollywood career have a lot more gray hair than you do, and I'm sure you've been asked for decades about what it was like to get into the business so early. But I have to ask you: is the legend true that you were discovered by a casting director for this film when you were cutting class at age 14?
Yeah, I mean, it always sounds strange to say discovered, you know, like, no, nobody likes to say they were discovered, you know, it just sounds, you know, a little bit weird, but yeah, I was like, I guess you could say that's more or less what happened. I mean, I was in junior high school and, you know, there were like 10 kids from my junior high school who were sort of brought down to audition for this film that was being made, but they were looking for, instead of using, professional actors, you know, they were looking for 14 and 15 year old kids that were, you know, sort of, I guess, what they said were real kids, you know. And so, you know, in the beginning, I thought, well, wow, this is going to be great, you know, I'll be in a movie. And then I found out there were thousands of kids who had auditioned for it. And some of them were, like, professionals who'd been in, like, the Bad News Bears and stuff. And I thought, well, I don't stand a chance against these guys. They're pros.
And you were in this film, Over the Edge.
Over the Edge. That was Over the Edge.
And right. Then you get these, you know, you appear in My Bodyguard playing the bully, and you're in these two great Francis Ford Coppola films, Rumblefish and The Outsiders. And then, you know, at a really early age, you've got this huge leading man teen idol thing going. You were here at an age when most kids, you know, are worrying about band practice and acne treatments, and you've got this huge thing happening. And there are stories of, like, Roger Ebert interviewing you. It's you know, at age 18, 19. And I can't help but think, you know, looking back now that you've got a little more maturity in years, do you ever look back and just wonder how you processed all that huge stuff and happening in your life?
Well,
or was it just a blast?
No, it was fun, but I mean, there were things that I remember that I look back at, like meeting Shelley Winters when I was 14 years old in Schwab's, and I remember, like, you know, there was something, I think there were certain principles, like some of the people that I was around early on in my career, you know, I was, for some reason, it seemed like I was surrounded by people who were affected by the blacklist. You know, they were either red diaper babies, their parents were blacklisted, or they themselves were blacklisted. They were married to somebody that was my acting teacher, my first director, the writer of the first film, Tim Hunter, Jonathan Kaplan. And the thing about a lot of those people were Walter Bernstein. These people really had principles, you know. And I think that was real. I was really lucky to be around people like that. And, you know, that coupled with the fact that, you know, I happened to be fortunate enough to get around the right people when I started. And also I came from a pretty good family background. I didn't immediately, once I started acting, become, you know, go to a professional, you know, a school for teenage actors or something. So I had this kind of dual thing going on. I was growing up and, you know, in the suburbs, hanging out with my friends, doing all that kind of stuff. Some of it was getting in trouble. Some of it was, you know, was just whatever kids do. And then there was this part of me who was going down to studying at the Lee Strasberg Institute and going to auditions and going to premieres of films and doing stuff like that.
In 2002, you directed the film, I guess co-wrote and directed the film City of Ghosts. Mm. It's sort of a story of intrigue and duplicity. You're the central character, Jimmy, sort of in a point reevaluating your life. And this is after you've been questioned by the FBI in an insurance scam in New York. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the film is actually set in Cambodia. Why Cambodia?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, I visited Cambodia in about 1993 with a friend of mine, a childhood friend I'd grown up with who was studying in Japan. And it wasn't, I hadn't planned on going. You know, I was on my way to Vietnam to, you know, I was in Thailand and I was almost going to be traveling around Southeast Asia. And it was suggested that, hey, you ought to go to visit Angkor Wat and see Cambodia while you still can, because the UN is there, so there is a degree of stability, you know. But that might not stick, you know. And so when I got there, I was taken with the country. There was something very cinematic about it and beautiful and also kind of dangerous and on the verge of a dramatic transition itself. And for whatever reason, it just stayed with me. And there was also something very totally atmospheric and there was, like, it had a fairy tale like quality to me, the city of Phnom Penh with its beautiful stupas and the palace, the royal palace, and the pagodas and along the Mekong River. And then there was this sort of at the time, this darkened streets, and there was a sense of kind of foreboding there as well. And it just stayed with me. And it wasn't till a couple years later that I decided that I wanted to write a film that was set there, and it was based on some of the people that I had met in my travels in Southeast Asia during that couple of months when I was over there, and some of the things that I witnessed, and that was the basis for this film. To me, it was always going to be set in Cambodia. I mean, it really was always one of the characters of the film, and the atmosphere is every bit as important to me as the structure and the plot.
One of the moments in this film, which I just love, is a bizarre evening where there's James Caan, the mentor, the kind of the leader of the scam artists, is at this nightclub, and there's sort of this menacing situation, and he does a karaoke song singing in Khmer. Where did that come from?
Well, to me, that's one of the magic moments of having made that film, you know, for me, was when Barry and I were writing that scene. We wrote, okay, and at that point, Marvin puts his head back, closes his eyes, and begins to sing in fluent Khmer. And I liked the way it sounded. And, of course, in my mind, I thought, well, depending on what actor we get to play Marvin, we can always change it to a Tony Bennett song if it has to be, or whatever it has to be, you know? And of course, then I said that to James Caan. I said, look, if you're uncomfortable learning to sing this in Khmer, he says, Matt, why do you think I took the friggin' job? You know, so Jimmy embraced it wholeheartedly. He's an intrepid actor, and that's what he did. And he's actually the talented singer. When we were sitting there and I was watching it, I was mesmerized. I had to pinch myself to see that I was watching this. And one of the Cambodian actors turned to me, who was not really an actor, but he was stunned. He said, his accent is perfect. He's fluent. He sounds like a Khmer. So that was a great moment for me to be able to watch Jimmy do that.
Matt Dillon. He stars in the new film Factotum. It opens next week.
Support for NPR comes from the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities on the web at wkkf.org. From the Annenberg Fund for Excellence in Communications and Education. And from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness on the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Alan Arkin. He's currently starring in the new comedy Little Miss Sunshine as a family's cantankerous grandfather who has a taste for porn and drugs and gets kicked out of his retirement home. I'm Dave Davies. Join us for the next Fresh Air.